You are really well known for 1Password, but your company is Agile Bits. Does that cause some confusion?
We always had these dreams of having more than one product. It's funny, at the very beginning, we actually named our company PalmSphere because, you know, the product at the time was, you know, a website dealing with Palm and Trios and things like that, like software. And so we just thought, you know, the company needs to be named after the product itself. And so we kind of learned our lessons on that. We, you know, after changing the name a few times, we settled on Agile Bits because it's flexible enough that we can basically, we can have any product we want and start building that brand.
I think I read that you started off at IBM and then you started having ambitions of Indie Glory.
Yeah, it's an interesting story. I started at IBM, geez, something like 98, but way back then. And I was working on Java at the time and I'm not really sure what I was thinking, but I absolutely loved it. You know, Java was where I was at. Everything about Java I just loved. And I worked there until about 2002, somewhere around in there. And so after a lot of reflecting, I just decided, you know, I'm just going to go it on my own. And that actually didn't turn out too well. So I left IBM, safe, secure job, and joined, it was a series of subcontracts, but it eventually worked its way through to Manpower. And I worked there for about maybe 2 or 3 weeks before the entire project got canned. And so now I'm trying to explain to my mom and, you know, my mother-in-law and father-in-law, yeah, I left a safe, secure job and now I'm just, you know, kind of sitting at home doing nothing. So it actually, you know, it wasn't a very good start, but, you know, I persevered and I went to World Vision and I met a lot of really good people there. And that's actually when I really got to know Rustam really well. And it was quite interesting there because, you know, he loved Java. I loved Java and we were working on, you know, some pretty interesting projects at World Vision at the time. Then we actually went to a few conferences like the Server-Side Symposium, things like that. And we, you know, we started opening our eyes that, you know what, there's much easier ways to do things than what we were doing. Like we were using WebSphere and like a full J2EE stack and all these types of things that I have nightmares about nowadays. And it, you know, we would try to present this to the people at World Vision that, you know what, there's better ways of doing this stuff. And it's a great big corporation. So pretty much we just got ignored. And so we actually just decided, well, let's at least start doing some things that we like to do, like for side projects and things like that. And I just remember Rustam was always, I don't know why, but I don't know where he got it in his head, but he was always talking about his Mac, like a Mac. Like we were complete PC guys back then. And he just kept on saying, you know, these Macs look so good. Like these PowerBooks look so good. But he just kept on talking about it. So one day, more of a joke than anything else, I just said, screw it. I'm going to go, you know, to the Apple store right now. Going to just, you know, buy myself a PowerBook. I bought
so,
it.
So, sorry, what year is this? This was like OS X period, right? Like 2002?
Yeah, this was like 2005.
Okay.
I actually just went and, you know, for this interview, I went and dug up my old PowerBook G4. I actually sat it right beside me to kind of remind myself because, like, this was like, you know, top end back then. And now I'm just looking at it and like, this thing's like a piece of junk. You know, it's got the floppy here and all these things. But anyways, so I was just, you know, Skyping him or whatever we were using back then. I was just like, you know, how do I sound coming from like a PowerBook? And, you know, so he got all jealous. And that was kind of the point because, like, I really wanted him to be jealous because I didn't want to do this myself, right? I didn't want to go to Mac and be the only guy at World Vision with the Mac. So I was trying my best to make him as jealous as possible. And the plan was if he never actually got jealous enough to go buy one, then I would just return it after a week. Like that was my grandiose plan. Thankfully he was just like, oh man, I got to have one too. So he ran out, got one and we started playing with Macs. But you have to remember back then we still loved Java. We really loved Java. But when we got our Macs, a very interesting thing happened. We found out these PowerPCs, they don't run Java very well at all. Like, right. I don't have any benchmarks offhand, but like I remember it was like half the speed or something like that.
Yeah, they didn't put as much work into the JVM for the PowerPC as they did on Intel.
Yeah, and I just I don't I think that's part of it, but I think, yeah, just the, yeah, the PowerPC itself just wasn't, I don't want to say capable, because obviously it was capable in other ways, but you know, it just wasn't tuned for Java at all. And so that's when we started thinking, well, we really like our Macs. We haven't had this much fun in years. So instead of like going back to PC so we can use Java, why don't we just do something other than Java? We went to a few conferences, and then we started hearing about this Rails thing. That was fun. This was like back in Rails, like 0.6. And so I played with it for a bit, and it looked pretty powerful. And, you know, my pride kind of got in the way, because like, I remember I went and watched a video by DHH. You have to remember, I was coming from like J2EE stack, like this full blown stack, to a much more simplified Spring framework with Hibernate. And I remember thinking, oh, I'm so smart, because like things are 10 times easier than they were, right?
Right.
And then I listened to DHH, and this guy just insulted like everyone who was using Hibernate. And I remember thinking to myself, this guy's just a jerk. So like, I like, you know, I love DHH, don't get me wrong. But at the time I was just like, this guy's just a jerk. He doesn't know what he's talking about either. So I was mad, and I walked away for a while. And then I eventually came back and started playing with it. And I was like, no, he's right. Like, why does Hibernate even exist? Like, I'm on this project that's brand new. I'm starting from scratch. Why the hell do I need like this, you know, object relational, you know, mapping, you know, I don't need that. So, you know, that's when I really started to love Rails. And again, this was just all on our side projects and things like that. And so we just started to make different websites with Rails, and quite honestly, just kept on cranking them out, throwing them at the wall, and trying to see what would stick.
So, okay, before we move on to where you built on from there, IBM around that time was very much into Java. Like, I remember late 90s, early 2000s, OS 2 was dying, and they basically decided it was just going to be a Java platform. They even rebranded it like E something to just run Java stuff. Definitely very heavily on the server side, like you were saying. There was a whole bunch of Java interest. Why do these big companies invest so heavily in Java, and what did you find commendable about it? Because obviously you were a fan. You keep saying you were a fan until, you know, many years after.
I think it's one of those things where, to be honest, I don't really know the answer to that question, but I do remember clearly, you have to remember, my dad is a C guy. Okay. So he's a C guy in and out, knows more about C than probably all of us put together. Like, he's really, really good at C. You want to do something different than your dad does. I don't know. I was just like, you know, he's doing this stuff that's like old school. I can never really catch up to him on that. And here's like these other tools over here that at the time, you know, they seemed a lot better than C.
So what did you like of it? Did you like that it was dynamic? Did you like that it was object oriented?
I like the simplicity of it, actually. Like, okay, things like packages. Like, I just love those. And I know you can kind of hack those into C as well. But I don't know. I picked it up in university, and I liked. I liked how I never had to really worry about memory. And then, of course, that turned out to be a lie. but you know, again, you know, I shouldn't admit it all, because like, it shows how naive I was at the time. But you know, I really did at the time just find it so much more, such a I'm not even sure what word to use, but a relaxing place to be. And it was easy to converse with other people who use Java. Like, I just never found that to be the case with.
Certainly Objective-C around that time was, you know, there's a very small community, so you can't. It was. I could see it if you were talking to a lot of people in the community. Java would have so many more people that you could talk to that had experiences with various systems that could help you out and offer you guidance and you could learn from, rather than like sort of a more minority platform.
And I distinctly remember at the time, like the recruiters would be coming to campus, and all they ever talked about was Java.
Right.
So I enjoyed it. It was something where I could say, I could do this better than you, Dad, type thing. I'm not taking that one too far, but you know, it was interesting, because like, I would actually be able to have arguments with my dad now, and I'd be like, oh no, you do it like this in Java. And you know, he'd be like, oh, that's cool. It was interesting. And then of course, people were willing to pay in those days, pretty big bucks for Java.
Right.
I'm not sure how the Java market is doing nowadays. I still get headhunters contacting me every once in a while. The rates don't seem to have gone up nearly as much as iOS developers.
Well, I think it's one of those things like, give it like 20, 30 years and, it'll be super expensive, like COBOL programmers are.
Yeah, so you're thinking maybe I should switch back, like just enough, like just keep.
Well, I mean, you can hope for some sort of Y2K sort of calamity coming up, because that paid handsomely for old hand COBOL programmers. They just got trucks of money backed up to them so that the world didn't explode.
So I just need to find a way to live to year 3K, right?
Or hope that there's some undetected bug in there somewhere that, you know, comes up sooner.
I guess the Unix, 2030 or something like that?
That's yeah, 37, I think, something like that. Yeah. So getting back on the career path thing, you started doing Ruby on Rails. Were they toy projects? Were they stuff that you hoped to make into a product or what?
Well, we were hoping to turn them into products. Again, we were working at World Vision full time. And so on weekends and nights, we would actually, we started programming with just the Spring framework and Hibernate. So we thought we were so good because like we cranked out like a new product in, you know, a couple weeks, which, you know, compared to what we were doing at World Vision was like incredibly fast, right? So we thought we were so smart. Then we started playing around with Rails, and then we found we could crank out like basically the same thing in a couple of days. And so we were like, okay, well, if we're running our own company, it's absolutely going to be Rails that we're going to go with. Mm. And so we actually started with our own website. So we had a few, I won't bore you with the details, but we had at least seven. You know, I was actually listing them in my head for this call, and I came up with four, and I can't remember the others. But I know we had just a lot of projects, and we'd create it, throw it at the wall, see if anyone cared. Most of the time they didn't. We would try to pitch it to people and, you know, see how much they'd be willing to pay for it. Most of the time it was, you know, very, very little. So it would move on. After a while of dealing with WebSphere, you know, I just started to realize it's just not the most, it's just not the best system for my type of development. Like, I'm not one of these guys who can just sit back, think of exactly how it should be, write it all out, and then just run it once and say, ooh, nice.
Right. The same way. I'm very iterative.
I have no choice. I have a very hard time thinking that far ahead. Like I need to iterate, see how it looks. And I go, okay, nice. You know, play the story over in my head again on how this interaction is going to work. Mm-hmm. You know, play with it a bit. Oh, I don't even like that. Let's just scrap that. Start over, you know, try going a different way.
Yeah.
And it works so much better for me. And then, so again, this tension that used to exist at World Vision and, you know, to a lesser extent at IBM. Yeah. I think a lot of that tension probably came from, you know, these people, they thought much differently than I did. They were more, hey, let's define this great big plan. And then let's every week, we'll just check in, you know, oh, how are you doing against this plan type thing? And I was always just like, well, let's just try to get something going first.
Right. They're serving the plan rather than the product.
Yeah, and I always found that very, very hard. Mm-hmm. Like at AgileBits right now, we don't have any project managers at all.
This is exactly where I was going. I was going to ask you how you avoid that at your own company.
Well, some days I really wish we had them. Because, like, again, they're very smart people. They help out in certain ways. It's just I would always be banging heads with them. So I just, you know, we haven't hired one yet here.
Does that mean you really don't have them, or that it falls on you and Rustam to be them?
I think it's more the latter, yeah. In fact,
just for the listeners, you got about 25 people now.
Yeah, I lose count.
Yeah, well, it's not three or four. You're a significantly sized organization that management, or at least some form of formalized communication, is an issue.
Well, there's a running joke that Rustam and I quote quite frequently, which is communication sucks at this company. And it really does, because like you make a decision and you think you tell everyone, but like, you know, you always leave a few key players out. Mm-hmm. And we're all distributed, right? That's the other thing. So we're about 20, 25 people, and we're all over the world. And so even if I wanted to have like a Skype call with like the whole team, it's actually a bit of a pain because, you know, different time zones and all these things. You know, I hate to say it, but I've been kind of getting in like the segregation type mode lately because I was just like, it's so hard to keep everyone on the same page at all the time. You know, it's much easier to just say, okay, look, you guys are responsible for this. Just go, you know, focus on that. And actually, part of me feels bad about that because I much prefer it when everyone knows everything. I just find it, I don't know, it helps morale. I feel it helps you right. Be more efficient because you're like, oh, Jamie's working on that. You know, I better, you know, I know something about that. Let me just quickly help him. These types of things.
Right. Well, it avoids a ghettoization too. Like if you have somebody working on a minority platform and they just get stuck there and they don't really get to hear what's going on with the rest of the company, I can see that being sort of alienating from the team.
Yeah, I think it can be, like, if you allow it to happen. And right. So I try to do my best to make sure I'm always involving people, like even if it's just a, you know, call them up and say hello. I do that quite often, just, you know, just call up, shoot the shit. Not even necessarily about work, just, you know, just keep that,
just keep in touch, right?
Keep the relationship there. Yeah.
Do you guys have a shared workspace? Like do you hang out on IRC or something, or?
We actually experiment with a different one pretty much every three or four months. We switch.
Yeah. So, they all stink,
so we were at, you know, Campfire there for a while. We tried IRC for a bit. Currently, we're working on we're using Flowdock, and I'm pretty happy with it. Like, I'm very bad with the concept of time, so I'm probably going to get this wrong. But I think we've been using Flowdock for about 6 months now, and I don't think anyone's really saying it's time to replace it. So I think we might have a keeper here for a bit.
That's good. And what does that afford you? Like real-time chat, plus you can sort of share documents kind of stuff?
Yeah, it's mainly we use it for the chat. And, yeah. You know, it's nice. You know, you can sit there and do like at Roostum and then like ask him a question. And then even if he's offline, it doesn't matter because like when he comes back online, you know, it'll be highlighted for him. Pretty simple things, but email, it just doesn't always work that well. And yeah. I really like having like discussions in Flowdock because everyone on the team is allowed to read them.
Right.
Now that to me, I think it's really great. Of course there's a flip side, which is if everyone's always reading everything, nothing ever gets done. So we try to maintain a balance there. We actually have a code room where like developers are supposed to go, but you know, the CS guys come in and chat when they need to. We have like a lounge where you're, you know, just, you know, try to build that team, like just, you know, personal stuff, right? Like just not so much discussing problems or anything like that. We have another room called Rainbow Warriors. We always liked this Inbox Zero thing. Mm-hmm. Who was that? Merlin. Merlin did the Inbox Zero talk so much, right? And so I was always talking about Inbox Zero. And after a while, like the team would work, they would get to zero and then they'd, you know, everyone would be screaming Inbox Zero and would be all happy. And we just, after a while, we just thought that was too much. It wasn't really our own. Like we just kind of stole that from Merlin. So, you know, we went with Rainbow Warriors because whenever it got to zero, we'd call it a rainbow. So.
Okay. You know, Merlin charges for that actually. There's a,
well, that's
one license of the reasons. It's hefty too. So
that's one of the reasons we had to switch. Because you know, yeah, his lawyers contacted us and
I know, he comes across as such a nice guy, but man, when he unleashes the hounds, it's not funny.
Yeah, for sure.
He's a serious guy, that guy.
But yeah, one interesting thing I wanted to just loop back there to, Renee mentioned how Roostum and I would take care of most of the project management stuff. It's like we've been doing this for like going into our eighth year now. And each year that goes by, I would find myself doing more and more email and less like X. And actually I was perfectly fine with that. I enjoyed it. It was great. Lately I've been kind of like, I want to get back into coding and I find myself quite rusty at it actually. And it's pretty hard to keep up and be awesome at something if you're only say doing it, you know, part-time, like basically half my day. So we actually hired one of my really good friends from IBM, and we brought him on board. His name's Jeff Shiner, and we brought him on board actually to be the CEO. And that's helped a lot, because like a lot of things that used to come to my inbox now to go to his inbox.
Right.
And, you know, same with Roostum, you know, like we get VCs calling us quite a bit and stuff. And so now they all kind of gravitate towards the CEO guy, and they kind of leave these, you know, these founders.
He's got the distracting title, right?
Right. And so we actually, when we went to the company page, we actually put Roostum down as founder.
I'm looking at it now. Brain and vision.
Yeah. Founder, brain and vision. That's right. And then we put me down as founder, heart and soul.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, they don't really mean too much. And part of it is just because we want to have fun with the titles. The other part is it's nice because VCs will come in. They're like, well, I don't really want to talk to the heart and soul guy. I want to talk to the
money guy.
Yeah, not the granola guy.
Right. So it actually works out pretty well. He's been here about 6 months now and well, maybe 8 months now.
So is he sort of your first step in, or he's like more of a management position, right? Or at least a coordination position?
Very much so. The only reason I allowed myself to even hire Jeff, though, was because he was extremely technical, like just extremely technical. So he's doing a lot of the coordination and these types of things. But some days he just, you know, rolls up his own sleeves and, you know, just does stuff himself, yeah. Which, you know, is really cool to see. You know, especially when he's in there and he changes some of my code because, you know, he just thinks it would be better this way. Or he's actually a lot nicer than that. He'll actually email me and say, yeah, I was looking at this and I was thinking about maybe making this change, right? And
so that crap you wrote Wednesday, I'm fixing it.
Right, yeah. He keeps that. You know, I'm sure after he's been here a bit longer, maybe he'll start talking that way, but we're still in the honeymoon period.
You bring up a really interesting point, because I used to have a bunch of buddies at Nortel when Nortel was still a thing, and they would always complain that management was whoever was next in line for the position would get the position regardless of what category it was in. So if there was a management slot or a VP slot available and you were the marketing guy or you were the comms guy, no matter who you were, you would get it. So one of them span boards and one of them did coding, and they would routinely get people who had no idea what they did as their managers, and it became an untenable situation. And it sounds like you're taking steps to make sure that the people in your, I don't want to say command chain because it sounds way too formal, but people in your decision-making process all know at the end of the day all the little bits and pixels that you're putting up in the apps.
Yeah, I've just, you know, I've always just had such respect for companies that are run by technical folks. Like 37 Signals is one of my, right. You know, one of the people I take a lot of inspiration from. And, you know, it's just, I'm not even sure if they have a single manager yet. I don't think they do. Pretty sure they don't. But anyway,
I know Valve works like that too. It's very
it's flat.
It's flat. Yeah, oddly so. Valve is the they make Half-Life and
I'm going to get the numbers wrong, but isn't GitHub like huge now? And yeah. they don't have any managers or no project managers. Anyways, I think.
Yeah, that's the way I understand it. Yeah.
And to be honest, I don't even know how they live, to be honest. I fight this temptation every day. Like whenever someone should have known something and it doesn't get done. And then I'm just like, I'm kicking myself. Cause like, I should have communicated it to them. I'm like, in the back of my mind, I'm like, man, if I had a project manager here, that probably would have got done. Right. And I have to balance that with, you know, I hate to say it, but my personal distaste of, you know, of thinking that far in the future, you know. Now, obviously, sometimes it would come in handy.
Well, it seems like a trust issue, really. Like, you want a right-hand person, effectively.
Right, yeah. And so I really believe probably one of Jeff's first hires will probably end up being a project manager one of these days. Like, currently, he's taking it all on himself, and he's doing a great job at it. But, you know, I'm thinking probably that's probably one of the weaker areas that we have.
Yeah.
Of course, I just want to hire more developers, but you know, we've hit the scale issue long ago, where mm-hmm. when we add someone new to the team, we actually don't get a full person out of them,
right?
You know, because coordination and all these things, it hasn't seemed to be working for us. So
there's an overhead.
Yeah, and to be honest, over time, you don't notice this, and it kind of sneaks up on you. But over time, I started realizing that, you know what. I actually don't like coordinating with all these people all the time, right? Like, and that was like my main role, right? And then like I kind of woke up one morning, I was like, huh, I actually want to be coding today, but instead I got like, you know, like four calls I got to make. And that's when I kind of realized, well, I created this company because I want to do what I love every day. And it's not that I hated what I was doing by any means. I loved it, but just not as much as I could feel it was like a diminishing return. It was on the downward slope. Like I still enjoyed it, but each day I could tell that, you know, it was getting farther and farther from coding, and I missed that.
One thing I'm curious about is now that you have you and you have Rustam and you've hired a CEO, does that change your – because I'm assuming you and Rustam just wrestle over anything you disagreed about previously. But now you have a third guy with a title in the mix. Does that create a different dynamic?
I was actually – I was quite worried about this, to be honest, because, you know, Rustam and I, we get along extremely well. We're basically like brothers. Like we know what each other's thinking, and the one can start talking and the other one will finish a sentence. Like we're really tight that way. And I was always like, you know, if I introduce like a third person here, isn't it kind of like adding like a, you know, an extra, you know, wife to a marriage? Like it's, you know, I'm obviously it's not, but you know, you're kind of like, yeah, you know, if they kind of fight, then, you know, what am I going to do? And this,
what if he takes his side?
Right. And so, you know, from day one, I got the two guys together and just, you know, basically you guys have to like each other or this isn't going anywhere. Right. And, thankfully they hit it off pretty well. And, you know, we all get along pretty well. You know, I don't want to say jealous. That's the wrong word, but you know, some days it's just like, you know, oh yeah. You know, like I'll be talking to Rustam and he'll be like, yeah, Jeff and I talked. That's already done. And like a small part of me is like, oh man, I wish I was part of that decision. But then the bigger part of me is like, oh, thank God I don't have to worry about that.
Right. Yeah. It's exactly why he's there, right? So you don't have to be part of that decision.
Exactly. And having three people is really nice because like if you have three people and you all trust each other like 100%, if two people agree, basically you don't mind. You're just like, well, I trust these guys. They both agreed on it. So yeah, let's just move forward.
Right.
I have so many projects or products in my head that I just want to get down on, you know, down into code one of these days. Mm-hmm. And, like quite literally some of them have been there for like 3 or 4 years and, you know, another running joke at the company is we, 1Password was supposed to be like a one month project is what it was supposed to be at the beginning. And so, you know, each month that goes by, we're just like, well, let's invest one more month in this product. Cause it's, you know, it seems to be working pretty well. And then after that, we're going to go work on this, you know, this product that we've been wanting for so long.
Okay. So let's go into the product sort of realm of what you do. You're on 5 platforms now.
Yeah.
4, if you count iPhone and iPad as one.
Yes.
You have a...
Which you can't because they're both exactly, so much
yeah,
work.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like maybe the back end is similar, but the front end's design is totally different.
Right.
You have quite a technical product. I know in the earlier days, you were doing fancy stuff to inject yourself into Safari.
Oh, those were the days.
Yeah. Yeah. And thankfully, things have progressed since then. But on each of these platforms, you have a pretty unique challenge in order to get your secure passwords into the user's browser of choice, or at least into a browser that you like on the iPhone that you have to sort of ship and maintain and develop. That's a broad spectrum of problems that you guys have to tackle.
Yeah. I feel like just saying yeah and then just like leaving dead air for like, you know,
it's the radio equivalent of scare quotes, I guess. But
well,
so what are the challenges of that? Do you share a lot of code? I know that you tossed out a bunch of stuff and you've rewritten stuff to be based on iOS 6. Was that a necessity or was that a luxury?
Well, I guess a little of both. Let's take a big step back. So you're right. Like 1Password on Mac is like a very technical product. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of browser integration. Even when you get it working with Safari, you have to worry about, well, how does it work in Chrome? Chrome's extension is completely different. Then of course you have to get it working in Firefox. Firefox completely different. And so like overall, you end up with a lot of support requests, right? Because there's just quite a few edge cases that you need to deal with. And so on iOS, we decided we'd start from a clean slate. One of the biggest reasons was we wanted it to be iOS 6 only so that we could just completely simplify things and just say, look, we support one OS. You know, we don't need to go testing on like old iPad ones, none of the stuff. We can just focus all our resources on, you know, on the new stuff. And we actually made the decision way back like 9 or 10 months ago, whenever it was, maybe 11 months ago now. And back then it was, you know, it was actually a scary decision, right? When we eventually released last week, the decision wasn't really that scary anymore because the iOS adoption has been so amazing. I think it's what, over 70% now. Yep. Yeah. Is iOS 6. We actually wanted to go back to the drawing board and simplify 1Password as much as we could. So we did a few things. We removed the multiple products from the App Store and instead just had one single universal app. That helped a lot. Amazingly, we got a lot of customer support like just a few weeks ago saying, well, which version of 1Password should I buy? And you never really want your customers asking that question. You know, right. You want it to be obvious to them.
Yeah. I mean, for every person that's bothered to ask, there's been like three more that have just walked away and not even bothered following up.
Exactly. Exactly. I personally always say it's 10 to 1.
Yeah.
But so, yeah, we wanted to remove as many questions as possible. So like one single app in the store, iOS 6 only. We actually, we're getting some flack for it right now, but we removed... Well, technically, we just did not add some features that caused a lot of pain. Mm-hmm. One of them was Wi-Fi syncing.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, it looks good on paper, but then, you know, we've always been a customer-driven company. Like when Rustam and I were, he was at IBM too, a different IBM, but like different building. Mm-hmm. But he was at IBM, he was at Sony, I was at, you know, World Vision. All these places, we weren't allowed to talk to the customers, right? Mm-hmm. And so... when we actually started talking with customers with 1Password, it was such a rush. And so we always try to communicate with our customers as much as we can. We like it so much. So now, of course, like I'm hearing from people who, you know, rely on Wi-Fi syncing and, you know, a lot of them are like incredibly nice, like very well worded emails just saying, you know, please bring it back because, you know, and they explain why. Like one guy's in China and, you know, he's not able to sync, you know, because of the great firewall of China. In terms of support, though, like I have to balance this because like I have this customer asking for, but Wi-Fi syncing was like one of those just terrible things. Like when someone contacted you and said, "I can't sync over Wi-Fi," your heart just sank because you're like, "Oh my God, what's wrong with this setup?" We had like this support document that had to be like 4 or 5 pages longer. 6 or 7 pages, like a very long one, and like all sorts of screenshots showing them how to like, you know, test whether Bonjour is working or not, see if the firewall settings are correct. Like it was just a mess.
Yeah, crazy peer-to-peer sync sessions seem like they'd be rife at the best of times. And then you sort of tack on the difficulties of Wi-Fi. And the other thing about your product, or 1Password in particular, is that the user places a lot of trust in it because it's literally got all of their secrets locked up and all of their passwords for any number of other secrets locked up. So if a sync session goes wrong, if you can't sync something, that is a terrible blow to, you know, how the person uses their computer and all of their services and their opinion of your product. So that when I say pulling Wi-Fi sync is a good idea, it's like, you know, one less thing to go wrong in a product that if anything goes wrong, it has a serious impact.
See, the thing with Wi-Fi syncing was, you know, it worked for quite a few people. So like, you know, like that's why it was there. And we used to use it ourselves for quite a while. And then just over time, we actually stopped using the feature entirely. Like no one on my team actually uses Wi-Fi syncing. And so product has to have like its own personality. And like, it comes from the people who actually use it, right? And like I use it every single day. And if I'm not using this feature every day, maybe it doesn't belong in the product. And so we've been thinking about removing it actually for quite a while. And so then when the 1Password 4 rewrite came along, we're just like, we're just not going to invest the time into doing this. Like certainly it's possible, like it exists today. And that's why it's so hard to explain to customers, because they're like, look, guys, you already did it. It's there. Just copy the code over and you'll be fine. And it's like, well, in theory, you're right. But no, like there's like a lot of like iOS 2 code in there and stuff like that.
It's hard to explain to people that like, well, you could have this, but it could be cumbersome or it could be problematic or, you know, it could fail in any way or that, you know, the code is atrophying.
There's a cost associated with it.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, not to say that your code's bust or anything, but I mean, if there's a code path that doesn't get exercised that much and it's one of significant complexity, which this is, it becomes a liability a bit to keep around after a while.
Yeah. I agree with that. Like, you know, I just, honestly, I feel bad right now. Cause like I've answered like quite a few people who want it back. And yeah, I try to remain positive and say, you know, just stick with version 3 for now and, you know, we'll see what we can do. I try not to give them too much hope because I'm quite certain I'm not going to be bringing Wi-Fi syncing back. But, you know, maybe we can accomplish this in a different way.
Right. That's probably the better way to look at it, is how do you leverage the sort of stuff that you do now in a way that can address the issues that most of these people didn't think that they need Wi-Fi syncing. Can deal with.
Yeah. And and basically if I'm not going to use it myself, I just don't think it should be in the product. I think it's probably the right way to look at it.
It's interesting because whenever you deal with customers, they want to tell you what solution they need and it's your job to figure out what problem they actually have.
Yeah. Well, we had this paid upgrade, right? So I can see it from their point of view. You know, I like supporting software, but if I, you know, paid for an upgrade and then I download it and then I find my favorite features missing, you know, I'm going to be mad too. So I can see it from their point of view. So we learned our lesson on that one. We quickly went and updated like the App Store description and our FAQs and things, just saying, hey, this is actually gone. So like if you're relying on this, you need to stick with version 3, at least for now, perhaps forever. But yeah, I can definitely see it from the customer's point of view. It's been an amazing launch week though. Like I've heard from so many customers and for the most part, you know, people are very happy supporting software. And we were all very nervous coming into this because like we saw what happened to Tweety and.
We should say you launched it as a new app, right? It wasn't a free update to everyone who had the previous version of 1Password. You literally put a new app in the store.
Exactly. And we turned off the other three. Yeah, exactly.
Have you had a lot of sort of pushback on that?
Not too much. Like we have a pretty big customer base. So like even when like 1% of them complain, it kind of sounds like the entire world's mad at you. Not that it is 1%. I actually don't know what the number is. I just made it up. But I've seen so much positive reaction. I've been called a few names that, I'm not going to say on air. So like you get the whole spectrum. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, people have been happy to, you know, cause, I guess I didn't really lead up to it, but like Renee said, we wrote an entire new app, submitted it to the store, completely separate app, turned off the existing ones. And then we gave like a 50% off, well, it's like 55%, you know, upgrade special because, you know, we wanted to allow people to upgrade, and the only way to do that is to just lower the price for everyone.
Right.
So that's the route that we took. And for the most part, people have been okay with that. You know, again, we're very customer focused here. So I just look at it and I'm like, well, how would I feel? Right. I always try to look at it that way. I'm like, how would I feel if I came to the App Store and I bought, you know, 1Password on like December 1st. And then on December 13th, there was like a brand new app out there. And like, how would I feel? Well, I'm not going to feel that great. Like even though I like supporting software, like, and I understand the limitations of the App Store, I'm not going to feel good. Right. Mm-hmm. And so we said like right in our FAQs, we're just like, you know, if you purchase within the last month, you know, contact us and we'll see what we can do. And, you know, we had some ideas in mind. The idea was we would go gift the application to them through iTunes. Turns out that's a really, really hard thing to do.
Yeah.
Like all sorts of fraud warnings and detections, and it's ridiculous. I can't believe how hard
it is. If you start doing massive amounts of gifting, they turn off your account very quickly.
Right. Because apparently no one in this world is generous, I guess. And so it's just very, very strange. Like I didn't expect that at all.
You know what? I had somebody gift me an album, or give me the gift of an album from the American store. And I couldn't redeem it in Canada.
Yeah.
So that was kind of pointless. He just sent me the MP3s anyway. But it's just silly. Anyway, sorry.
I'm glad you brought that up. We actually, in our back office, like for our help desk system, we have a few buckets set up. We actually have a bucket for like Canadian gifts, a bucket for US gifts, and a bucket for UK gifts. And because we have people in all these countries. If you're outside of those countries, we actually can't gift it to you. We're stuck.
Right. Yeah.
And so we actually just said, well, we'll send them some money through PayPal.
We've had to do that too.
And of course, you know, PayPal takes a lot of fees. And so we actually have to overpay so that, you know, by the time the fees get taken out, the customer gets, you know, what they should have. Right. Yeah. And some people can't even do the PayPal. Not really sure why. I don't know if it's a trust issue or just not available in the country, but some people are just completely against it. So for these guys, we literally just said, we'll mail you a check. I know it sounds ridiculous, and it really is, but at the end of the day, it's all coming from that customer point of view of, well, how would you feel if you just bought this and then you had a paid upgrade just a couple of days later?
And to your credit, I mean, you're not just giving them the app. You're paying Apple 30% to actually ship a copy of your app to this customer.
Absolutely.
So you're actually out of pocket on these things.
Yeah. So I actually get lucky if I can gift the app to them. Because if I can gift the app to them, I only lose 30%. If I have to use PayPal, I lose like, because it's usually international, right? So it's like I lose 3.9% plus 30 cents, plus just the way I have it set up. Like, I don't know. It's a long story, but the fees get way up there. The mailing an actual check in some ways seems easier, which is just, it's just crazy. So long story short, I'm not sure if I would recommend anyone else do a similar thing with refunds. I know Omni does, mm-hmm. Omni Group does similar thing with refunds. That's actually where we got our inspiration from. It's turned out to be such a pain. I'm not sure if we'll do it again for the next release. Ideally, I would be able to refund anyone anytime, and it would like solve so many issues. Because
ideally, you'd have paid upgrades in the App Store.
Well, paid upgrades is, you know, that'd be wonderful. I would love to have that. I'm not holding my breath for that one. Refunds just seems, of course, I'm on the outside looking in. Refunds just seems like one of those things that is relatively easy. Hmm. Of course, it's not, because Apple tries not to let me know who my customers are. But I just can't help but to think there's some solution there where a customer could write in like some form on Apple. They'll go into that form, say, I want a refund. An email would be sent to me saying, this customer wants a refund. And I click like yes or no. And I would just always click yes. Mm-hmm. Like, $8 is not worth having someone on there leaving a one-star review or, you know, being upset. You know, you were talking about cost there, Renee. Well, you know, you have all these fees, but now I have to pay someone. It's going to take like about 2 or 3 days just to refund 1,000 people. Like, yeah. It's so manual. So,
but that's probably a spike just because of the release.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. So you deal with that for like a week or two, and then you sort of back to normal.
Well, what we actually want to do, ideally, we would just plaster the money back guarantee everywhere. like it throughout, like all the homepage, like all the marketing materials, the description page in the App Store, just mm-hmm. absolutely everywhere. Because it works so well. Like you come, you look at the product, you're like, I think I might like that. But I better not buy because I might not like it. Then you're like, you see the guarantee and you're like, huh, all right, let me give it a try. You try it for a bit, you know, 9 times out of 10, you're going to like it and, you know, you're going to move forward. So overall, it would help sales a lot.
Because you're not a zero or a $1 app. You're a full paid app. I think, what are you normally priced? $14.99?
Well, the universal app is going to be $17.99. Okay. And currently it's $7.99 because we have this upgrade special that's going on until the end of the year.
And the desktop ones are $50, right?
Yeah, $50.
Yeah. I wonder if Apple would be cool with you just sticking money back guarantee everywhere. Because it's kind of hard for you to actually guarantee it.
Well,
but whatever, that's tangential. I don't know.
I talked to Ken Case a little bit about that, one of the WWDCs, and he said that Apple does get sensitive because, like, if the money back guarantee isn't, if the customer misreads the money back guarantee as coming from Apple, then Apple's not very happy because it increases their support. But as long as you're very clear about it coming from you, it doesn't seem to be an issue. Now, mind you, if you go and look at Omni's products right now, they don't have the money back guarantee on the App Store description. It's only on their website, which is exactly what we did in the short term because, quite frankly, we didn't want to get rejected. You know. at this stage in the game, like we're going to try again in January just to update the description and see if it flies or not.
I think most of our friends out there in Radio Land are probably Apple people. But you also ship on Windows and Android.
Yes.
How does developing for those platforms differ? How do you keep everything in sync? And how does this sort of the store experience, is it similar? Is it totally different?
Well, so Roostum and I came from the PC land and we were happy when we were there. But when we got to Mac, we loved being here and we didn't really want to go back, to be honest. And so customers kept on asking for Windows. And honestly, we said no for a long time. But they got to us. They found some sweet spots. And one of the sweet spots – or soft spots, sorry, soft spots. One of the soft spots they found on me was they would sit there and describe how much they loved their Mac. And, you know – And they use 1Password, but then they got to go to work, and then they're, you know, they're forced to use this PC. And please, is there anything I can do to help? And you know, after a few of those, I started saying, okay, you know, we really do need to do a Windows product, especially for, you know, a password management app that like wants you to go generate new, you know, passwords that you can't memorize. Right?
It almost has to be everywhere.
It almost has to be, yes. And so we actually. We didn't know what to do. We're like, yeah, we want this, but what am I going to do? And actually, we had a guy contact us and he just said, oh, I really like your product. I'm a Windows developer and, you know, you guys aren't here. I want you to be here. So let me write it for you. And we're just like, you know, is he kidding? Is he good? Is he, you know, these types of things. And, so we felt him out for a little bit and then, you know, we're like, oh, this guy is actually the real deal. And so, you know, we hired him and he wrote 1Password for Windows, pretty much 100% on his own. Now we helped him with like the, you know, the data format and how the encryption works and these types of things. So obviously we helped a bit, but for the most part, it was just completely him all on his own. Kind of a similar story for Android. And Windows Phone 7 actually. Well, Windows Phone. Let's just stick with that. We have another guy who basically just does that. So he doesn't work on Mac, and he it's not that he doesn't like Mac. He's just he likes Android. He loves Android. So let him develop that. Same with Windows. You know, he loved Windows. He had a Mac, but he just loved Windows more. So more power to you.
Yeah.
So
well, I mean, it works out well for your company and for your customers and for everybody if they're enjoying what they do.
Well, sometimes I feel bad though. Like I I can't even go, like, I like being able to go grab the code, look at it anytime I want, build it and release it myself, right? Well, on Windows and Android, you know, like, basically I don't even know what I'm doing. I have to go to like a set of documents and just, you know,
Figure out how to get the toolchain set up and
start by installing this. And it's just like, oh, you know, so sometimes you just, you know, I like to know things, and then you sit there and you look at it and you're like, I know almost nothing about that. So I need to invest some time there.
Were there issues with the synchronization with other platforms and iOS? You know, I'm taking Mac and iOS to be your baseline and the other platforms to be sort of having to hook into essentially a Mac or an Apple-centric ecosystem. Were there hurdles to overcome there?
Well, yeah, like we started with Dropbox was our main guy. Like, we had Wi-Fi sync and stuff, so we kind of solved a lot of the synchronization issues. Like, but then Dropbox is where we landed, and we stayed there for a long time. And we, like, Rustam and I, mainly Rustam, he's too smart to keep up with, so he's always in the lead. But you know, we designed this, we took care of the syncing for Dropbox and specifically for iOS and Mac. And then when Windows came along, it was like, okay, well, this is how we're doing it. Follow the same set of rules. We of course did have some issues. Just, you know, oversights is like, we thought it was clear that this is the way it was supposed to be done. But, you know, the order would be different or something like that.
Right.
And, you know, it would cause issues. Same for like the browsers, the browsers on Mac right now. Mm-hmm. Like, technically you have the data actually synchronizes between Safari, let's say, and the one main 1Password app. So there's actually technically two copies of the data there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we have to, every time there's a modification, we run the sync to keep these guys going. And on Windows, I know a couple of these were like we had a certain protocol that you'd follow, and the one, you know, it's like little things like hello, and then, like, you know, he responds, and like you had the certain order you had to go in. And I remember he actually skipped one of them on purpose because he was like, well, it doesn't seem to be doing anything. And actually it wasn't mandatory by any means, but it, you know, it was helpful in certain ways. So when we would go and implement something in maybe we should go with Chrome now that Safari is not really on Windows anymore. Mm-hmm. When we would implement something in Chrome, then it would go and run on Windows and it would behave differently. And we're like, what the hell, you know? And then we'd realize, like the protocol is just a little bit different on Windows. So nothing earth-shattering, but yeah, you always had to stay alert for these things.
Because it seems to me that there's a core of 1Password, which is basically the cryptographic data store of all the passwords and probably generating the password. And that's probably portable across or reasonably easy to implement or port across these multiple platforms. But you touch so much platform-specific from the UI to the way the syncing engine works to sticking your code into, you know, to Safari or Chrome extensions. What's the breakdown on the app? Like the core functionality is like sort of how much percent of the sort of the code base or of your time invested do you think goes into that?
Yeah, we actually, it's actually gotten better like recently. Let's take an example. Like, we used to inject, you know, do code injection directly into Safari, yeah, and that was really cool and lots of fun. It really was. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's a pretty fun thing to do.
But then there was always this little issue where Apple would release updates every once in a while. Mm-hmm. And whenever they release an update, like, we of course would be very, you know, very, very conservative, and it'd be like, okay, this version's changed. We're not doing any code injection there whatsoever. And so basically nothing would work. The customer, you know, at the beginning of time, our customers were very technical. So the customer would just automatically say, oh, I updated Safari. I better go update 1Password. And, you know, everything was fine. Over time, our customer base started becoming less and less technical. And so when there was like a Safari update, we would literally spend days just answering like so many emails about, you know, how to upgrade and all these types of things. And it became like a really, really big time sink. Recently with Safari's, you know, extension support, it's become like just trivial now. Like Safari gets updated, doesn't matter. Like nothing changes. You don't even have to upgrade 1Password if you don't want to, and it will continue to work. So actually our time investment there has actually been reduced quite a bit. But I guess it's give and take, right? Because then we kind of took that time, we reinvested it into, you know, for instance, on iOS, like really, really trying to take a lot of time to polish the UI and right. You know, make it everything Dan wanted it to be.
Yeah, it's looking really great these days. So what's next? You said something that, you know, you mentioned that you wanted to work on other projects, so you had other stuff in mind. I don't actually expect you to tell us what they are, but do you have any sort of like, you know, you're at 25 people now, you've been growing quite quickly. Sort of what are the plans either for 1Password or for Agile Bits?
Well, for 1Password itself, we really wanted to, like a big part of this iOS redesign was to just, you know, completely simplify things. And we want to take that simplification and drive it through like all the other platforms. So that's one of our goals going forward. So what's next? I would say it's going to be like 1Password for Mac. He's next on the list. And then of course the other platforms as well. So there's actually quite a bit of work remaining there, to be done. What I stay up dreaming about at night is like a couple of other products that I've been wanting to do for a while. Some of them complement 1Password quite a bit, and would really market well to the customer base. Others are, well, like one's actually a game that I've been trying to write for the longest time. Turns out I actually, like way back when, I can't even remember the dates, had to have been like 92 or something like that. Like 20 years ago, I used to sell shareware, and it was like a risk based game, like with the little men that you moved around and all these things. And I sold it on like CompuServe, and people would mail me stuff.
Wow.
Like they'd mail me a check, and I would, you know, I'd take the check and then I'd mail them back like a 3.5-inch, you know, floppy.
That's awesome. That's old school shareware style. Well, I like that.
It was awesome. And funny thing was, back then, you know, I was young, right? And back then, I didn't think it was a real job. I didn't think you were allowed to do that, right? this was just, you know, who the hell works at home making software and then sells it and, you know, makes a living off it? Like that's just crazy. So, you know,
well, 92, that was like id Software was starting to do like Wolfenstein 3D and Doom was around that time. And
Yep.
Commander Keen, you were right at the cusp of the shareware sort of tidal wave.
Yeah. And, you know, my life could have taken a different path pretty easily. But at that time, I decided, you know what, this is like a hobby, right? And so I went to university and got a real job and all that stuff. And so it's quite funny because about, you know, what, 10 or 15 years later, whatever it is, I came back and like now I'm basically doing the exact same thing, you know, making software at home and selling it and making a living off of it. So,
yeah, but now you're part of the app economy.
Yeah.
It's totally different now.
To be honest, I forget how I got on that thread. I forget what you
said. Oh, I asked you what the future plans were.
Oh,
and
you
went backwards.
One of my products is actually to go back to that game that I had way back when and rewrite it for iPad. So that's actually one of my dreams. I don't know if I'll ever get to it, to be honest, but it's maybe I'll make that like a project to do with my kids.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Something like that. My daughter's 7 and my boy is 4, so it's going to be a while before I can teach them, you know, Objective-C and this type of stuff.
Yeah, that's going to be a bit of a leap. I started programming around 7 with an Apple II. But like, you know, back in the day, they used to have those books where you could just type in a program. Yeah. And mine was like a game, and I typed it all in, and I'd have syntax errors because I typed something wrong.
Yep.
And then I would just delete the line because you could just, it was like basic. You could just type like 110, enter, and the line would be gone. And I'd keep doing that until I had no syntax. Of course, the app didn't work, and I had to retype it all in again. But slowly started learning, and then learn how to tweak and how things different things worked. So that seems fun. Like if you can get your kids into
yeah. So since you started at 7, I guess I better go home right now and yell at Abby and just say, hey.
Yeah, you know, she's a real underachiever. You better, you know.
Yeah, you've been slacking, and it's time for you to get started on.
You know, it's different these days because in those days, it felt like you could do something that was kind of on par with this software that's almost shipped with the computer. Not really, but. Like
well,
you could type,
for a while there, yes.
Characters moving around your screen, and it would be like, well, that's not too far off from like the
it looks
giant
like block. Urine.
Yeah, exactly. These days, it's really hard to make something that looks satisfyingly professional, I think.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, maybe web browser stuff is, but that's a mess to deal with. Like, there's so many concepts going on there.
Yeah, I don't want to expose my daughter to that.
How's the extension stuff with Safari? Is that good enough for kids? Is that a robust enough thing for them to start with?
It's pretty tough sledding there because, like, obviously I could simplify it for them, but my experience with 1Password is it's very tough sledding because each browser does it completely differently. Like there's a lot of reuse, of course, but you know, they all have these little different ways of doing it their own way, and it causes a lot of.
The thing with extensions too is that you need to understand what the DOM is and what you're like how you're going to manipulate the page that's already loaded. Like you need a lot of concepts in your head before you even start writing an extension. Compared to like a super basic, you know, enter like input a $, what is my name kind of app.
Yeah, I kind of feel like, you know, just going back to Turing, to be honest, like not personally, obviously, but like for my daughter. Going back to Turing and just starting with something really, really simple like that and see if I can get her, you know, like I got bit by the bug, I don't know, when I was 9 or 10 or 11, somewhere around there. I can't remember when. And, you know, I just couldn't stop thinking about it.
You get that endorphin of like typing something, seeing it work, and then you iterate and finally when it's working the way you want it, you feel great.
Yeah.
You spend most of the time feeling kind of annoyed and terrible, but otherwise it's fun.
That's what makes it worth it at the end, though.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think so. Yeah.
Yep.
Actually, I had a question about the extensions. It sounded for a while when Chrome was doing extensions, then finally Apple started doing extensions, that it was kind of competitive and that people were trying to it was almost like your browser had to have it to be a good browser. And now you don't hear much about it. You don't hear much about Google improving support. Apple, they did their song and dance, and then it kind of went quiet again. Are they still improving extension support?
Slowly. Like, obviously, I'm on the outside looking in, so I believe everything should be going faster, and they should be implementing what I want. But, yeah, it does seem to have slowed down. Like, that's my feeling. My personal wish though is like obviously this is near and dear to my heart. Like if extensions go away, like my life gets a lot more difficult. And so on iOS, I've been wanting, you know, extensions in Mobile Safari since day one. And when Chrome came on the App Store, I was like, oh, this is great. You know, I was just making it up, obviously, but I was like, in a couple months, these guys are going to have like extension support. And then Apple's going to get jealous and they're going to have to add it to Mobile Safari. And I'm still waiting for that. I forget who I was talking to, but they mentioned, well, you know, it might be disallowed just because, you know, downloading code type thing, you know, against the App Store rules. But I still think it'd be great if Chrome could find a way to get extension support and, you know, actually, because I'm pretty sure all us geeks would flock over to Chrome. Like, I already have it, but like, I mainly stick with just Mobile Safari. But like, if Chrome had extension support, I would basically switch over there a lot faster and use that a lot more. And you know, it'd kind of force Apple's hand. But we all know Apple moves at their own pace, so it might be a while.
You'd go to Chrome even though it couldn't use the speedy JVM?
To be honest, I don't really notice the difference. Like in the built-in browser in 1Password, for the most part, I just don't notice the difference. Like absolutely for benchmarking, there's a big difference. But there comes a point when it's fast enough that you don't really perceive it anymore.
Mm-hmm. Also, you don't tend to be doing a lot of really super heavy JVM stuff on your phone necessarily.
Right.
Like the pages are smaller and less funky stuff going on usually. You know?
I could see if you were playing Farmville or something like that you'd be very concerned about that.
Right. You really need your 120 frames per second in Farmville.
Exactly.
Hey, we've gone light years ahead of the old JavaScript bookmarklet we started with 1Password on iPhone.
That was awesome. Remember Steve Jobs stood up and said, we wrote all these apps and we're not going to let you guys write it, but don't worry. We got something even better. You can just, write HTML. And so we heard that and we were like, okay. So we played with that for a while. And we came up with this bookmarklet idea, which was pretty cool. You would generate it in 1Password on Mac. We would store it in your Safari bookmarks. And then MobileMe would sync it over. And for the most part, it worked pretty well. There was, of course, a bunch of edge cases that got us. One being the bookmarklet would be really large. Like between 50 and 100K, sometimes bigger. And often MobileMe, he just didn't he wasn't tuned for this type of thing. So every once in a while, he would just sync it continuously.
He was a capricious friend on the best of occasions.
Yeah. So he would sync it continuously. So you would end up with thousands of these bookmarks, bookmarklets. So that was really painful. But the biggest thing holding back the bookmarklet was basically state preservation. So what would happen is you would go to a website every time that page reloads, all my state's gone. So you would load up the bookmarklet, would put like a nice little window there asking for your master password, so we could unlock. And of course you would have to type it every single time because the page would just keep on getting reloaded. So it actually, it worked. We're so happy that we have official, apps now on iOS because, it works so much better now as a separate app. That was another one of those things that we ended up removing. Users were using it, a certain subset of users were using it and they enjoyed it. But we stopped using it. We didn't use it for quite a while. It was causing quite a bit of support. So we ended up just nixing it.
Yeah. It's, it's the Brent Simmons doctrine of just cut stuff that you don't use.
Yeah. And I think it's a really good attitude to have in general. I'm actually sending a newsletter later on today. I still find newsletters to be very effective. I you can be very personal in the newsletters and people really enjoy it. And I end the newsletter by saying, thank you so much for, thank you so much for allowing me to work at something that I love and get paid doing it and, make a living off of it. Because at the end of the day, it all boils down to the customers. If they weren't purchasing the product, I'd probably be back in Toronto right now at some big corporation somewhere.
Yeah. Writing Java for HP or something.
That actually is a good motivator.